Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm joined tonight by my friends and co-hosts. I have Sam and Jennifer. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Tonight, our guest is Mavish Rahim to discuss potentially curative therapies for sickle cell disease. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us what the show is all about?
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Mavish Rahim. Mavish Rahim is a pediatric stem cell transplanter at the Children's Hospital of Montefiore who has an interest in curative and transformative therapies for patients with leukemia and sickle cell disease. Today, she teaches us the fundamentals of the exciting new landscape of potentially curative therapies for sickle cell disease and helps us understand who are candidates for stem cell transplant and gene therapy. So, Chris, I have a pun for you. Why do you think that I always iron my favorite pair of Levi's?
Why?
I like my jeans crisper.
Yeah! Nice!
That was great. Best pun yet.
This is not one of mine. It's definitely better than all the other ones we've had. Hello, Dr. Rahim. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, thank you guys for having me.
First, because we're an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Of course.
All right. And it's Mavish, is that right?
Yes.
Excellent. All right. So let's just start with some rapid fire questions just so we can get to know you a little better. Can you give us a little bit about something about yourself? You know, can you describe yourself a little and maybe something outside of medicine that you like to do?
Yeah. So I'm currently a stem cell transplanter at Children's Hospital at Montefiore in the Bronx. Specifically caring for patients with leukemia and patients with sickle cell disease, going to transplant or gene therapy. And something outside of medicine, I love horses and I enjoy horseback riding in some of my free time.
You got to have a good follow-up question to that. I don't know anything about horses, so I can't.
Yeah, I don't know nothing.
There's not much of a follow-up question, I guess, mainly because I haven't been riding as frequently with the interruption of medical school training and then attending hood or being an attending. So now it's...
I heard medicine was busy. Yeah.
A little bit.
I don't know what happened. That's what they say.
Speaking of horse knowledge, like, do horses have diseases like sickle cell?
I do know that there's a whole large veterinary specialty for large animals, but I actually don't know if they have sickle cell disease, and that will be my next Google search.
We're going to embarrass ourselves in front of all the veterinarians that may or may not listen to this show.
because the veterinarians who listen to the show are going to be clicking on the sickle cell treatment episode.
Right. They're like, did you just ask if the horse has sickle cell?
I do know that dogs can have von Willebrand disease. That's my only hematology sort of factoid. And I wanted to know, as a trainee, I'm always trying to glean wisdom from others. What would you say is the best piece of advice that you received, either as a trainee or just generally in your medical career?
Yeah, definitely. One of the best pieces of advice I think that I've learned throughout my throughout every stage of my journey, like as a learner, trainee, educator through my career, is kind of to listen to everyone, watch everyone, and just recognize that there's something to learn from everyone, regardless of their position or their experience. Staying curious and open to observe what resonates with you from each of those people, and then kind of integrating those insights into your own approach as you approach anything in life and in medicine.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a listening paying attention. Everyone offers something important opinion. I mean, that's always good advice. We get such good advice here on the show. I actually think it's our best question that that we ask. So we just put it all together and then we say, hey, you know, we got a lot of wisdom that's coming on. Hey, Cribsiders listeners, this new year, nothing hits like home cooking, especially when you spend your days working in the hospital and just want dinner to be easy and actually good. That's why HelloFresh has become such a staple for us. And after long shifts, the last thing I want to do is plan a meal from scratch. HelloFresh takes that off your plate with simple, easy-to-cook recipes that still feel thoughtful and satisfying, even on the busiest of weeknights. And so they have over 100 recipes every week, and I'm especially impressed by how strong their vegetable-forward options are. Their Mediterranean-style meals are easily the best. Lots of vegetables, grains, olive oil, herbs, and bold flavors that leave you feeling full and happy. And the portions are so generous, no one leaves the table feeling hungry. So HelloFresh also makes it easier to eat well. With over 35 high-protein recipes each week, including new Mediterranean and GLP-1 friendly options, all made with wholesome ingredients like sustainably sourced seafood and 100% antibiotic and hormone-free chicken. You also get steak, seafood, and 3 times more seafood options at no extra cost, plus tons of seasonal produce. Because when dinner tastes this good, nothing hits like home cooking. And so I use HelloFresh, and you should too. Go to HelloFresh.com/Cribsiders10FM to get 10 free meals plus a free Zwilling knife, a $144.99 value on your third box. That's HelloFresh.com/Cribsiders10FM. And this offer valid while supplies last. Free meals applied as discount on the first box. New subscribers only, and it varies by plan. You know what really eats up time when you're running a small business or side project? Payroll and HR. I've had days where a quick admin task turns into hours of forms, logins, and double-checking tax stuff, and I remember thinking, there has got to be a better way to do this. That's why I'm a big fan of Gusto. Gusto is online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. What I love is how much it automates. Payroll tax filing just happens. Direct deposits are simple. And all the onboarding paperwork, offer letters, forms, everything gets handled in one place instead of scattered across my inbox. Plus, you get unlimited payroll runs for one monthly price, which means no surprises when things get busy. And if you ever have a tricky HR situation, Gusto gives you direct access to certified HR experts, which is honestly a huge peace of mind. And so, if you're ready to save time and skip the admin headaches, try Gusto today at gusto.com/cribsiders and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 free months of payroll at gusto.com/cribsiders. One more time, gusto.com/cribsiders.
So we have a case from Cashlec Children's Hospital. Mehi is a 9-year-old boy with sickle cell disease, hemoglobin SS. Both of his parents and his younger sister have sickle cell trait. Mehi is followed regularly in hematology clinic and rarely misses doses of his hydroxyurea. Over the past year, Mehi has had 3 admissions for acute chest syndrome and vaso-occlusive pain episodes. At his follow-up visit today, Mehi's mother said that she has heard that there is a new cure for sickle cell disease and wants to learn more. So to start us off with, I was hoping that you could give us just a quick 101 overview of what we're talking about when we're talking about potentially curative therapies for sickle cell disease.
Yeah, of course. So I'm going to start a little bit at the basics to get you a good explanation for that. So all of us have bone marrow, and that lives inside of our bones. And the bone marrow is home to stem cells, or immature cells that develop into white blood cells that help us fight infections, red blood cells that carry nutrition and oxygen throughout our body, and platelets that help us clot if we bleed. In patients with sickle cell disease, the body produces red blood cells that can become misshapen or sickled during times of stress. These sickle cells then can lead to a range of complications throughout the life of a patient with sickle cell disease. The goal of stem cell transplant is to correct the problem at its source, or the bone marrow, which is the factory that's producing these faulty cells. And the fix for that is to introduce healthy donor stem cells that produce normal red blood cells. The overall process involves the use of chemotherapy to clean out the patient's existing stem cells and make space for new healthy donor stem cells to grow. Gene therapy is a newer transformative option that follows a very similar concept to stem cell transplant, but instead of using donor stem cells, they're using the patient's own stem cells that have been genetically modified to either boost the production of healthy adult hemoglobin or increase levels of fetal hemoglobin, which then help prevent sickling of the red blood cells.
And I'm going to back us up even earlier, if that's okay. I know you're even starting the basics here. You know, we say that we're going to do stem cells to make normal, what you would call normal red blood cell compared to sickle red blood cells. Can we just go through what's wrong in the, when you have hemoglobin SS, what is wrong with the red blood cells? And then we can talk about how you would replace them even before we talk about the context in which we do it.
So what is wrong with the red blood cells is that there is a point mutation at the genetic level that is resulting in our nice round red blood cells to become sickled in shape at times of stress. And those that could include dehydration, infections, the cold weather. And because of that point mutation, the red blood cells do not stay round and rather sickle in shape and then can cause downstream effects for various organs.
And so it sounds like, and before we kind of get into this, the smaller details, it sounds like this is a single point mutation. So if we can introduce normal cells, either someone else, and that's the bone marrow transplant that you're talking about, versus even the gene therapy to convert this single point mutation, then we should be able to, quote, cure the disease. Is that my understanding correct?
Yeah. And stem cell transplant, you're looking at a curative approach because you are putting in a whole new set of stem cells. So you're not impacting that genetic mutation for the individual patient. And for gene therapy, you are genetically modifying the cell, not necessarily to impact that point mutation, but rather to change the way that hemoglobin is being expressed, whether it is hemoglobin A or hemoglobin F that's being produced based on the product that is being used. And we often refer to gene therapy currently as a transformative process rather than curative at this point, given how new gene therapy is. So when considering treatment options for a patient like Mehi, the first step is really to evaluate donor possibilities, specifically whether the younger sister you mentioned could be a stem cell transplant donor. And this is determined through HLA testing to see if she would be a perfect match or an identical HLA match. If she is, the standard of care would be a matched sibling donor stem cell transplant. Siblings have a 25% chance of being an identical HLA match. If she is not an HLA match, we would then be able to assess Mehi and see if he meets the criteria for commercially available gene therapy products. And in discussions with families about stem cell transplant or gene therapy, we would review both the potential benefits and possible side effects of each treatment option.
And I think that's a great opportunity to kind of talk about that. So who are the candidates, right? Who's the ideal candidate for the bone marrow transplant? Obviously, you have to have a 25% chance of HLA matching, it sounds like. And then who's an ideal candidate for the gene therapy? And if you could kind of walk us through that piece.
That question is extraordinarily nuanced, and you could ask,
which
is great, but I'm going to start by saying that you could ask 10 transplanters this question, and you'll get 11 different answers. So when I think about who is an ideal candidate for transplant or for gene therapy, I like to go into the history a bit, the history of stem cell transplant for patients with sickle cell disease. The first transplant for a patient with sickle cell disease was actually performed in 1984 on a patient who was undergoing a transplant for their acute myeloid leukemia diagnosis. And incidentally, the transplant also cured the patient's sickle cell disease. Since then, the approach has been that patients with quote-unquote enough sickle cell disease burden, which is defined in various ways, and who has a good match sibling donor option for a donor, are good candidates for stem cell transplant. Overall, the success rate of stem cell transplant for patients with sickle cell disease who have a match sibling donor is as high as 95% when both the donor and recipient are younger. Given the high success rates, many experts will recommend early intervention with a matched sibling donor transplant to prevent the long-term damage from sickle cell disease. So in that way, the ideal candidate for transplant is typically a patient with a matched sibling donor, regardless of their disease burden from sickle cell disease. Another way to kind of spin that is thinking about identifying the ideal transplant candidate by assessing the impact that the patient has from their disease. And for patients with a significant disease burden but no matched sibling donor, there's emerging data that supports the use of a haploidentical or a half-matched stem cell transplant. That being said, a half-matched transplant doesn't mean half the success. We have ways to manipulate the process so that you can have good success for a haploidentical stem cell transplant. And that consideration of disease burden then overlaps with the eligibility for gene therapy, because commercial gene therapy products have very specific criteria regarding the number of vaso-occlusive events and acute chest syndrome events that a patient needs to have had to qualify for gene therapy.
Can I ask a quick question? I think I knew this at one point, can you talk a little bit about why a sibling that's matched is a better choice than, say, any other relative, say like a father or a mother?
Yeah. So that gets into how do you get a matched sibling donor? So when we look at HLA matching, it's all based on our genetics. We get half our genetics from mom, half our genetics from dad. So by definition, a parent is always going to be a haploidentical or half-matched donor. And if you remember your Punnett squares from way back when, that then means that siblings have the opportunity to get the same half of the genetics from mom, the same half of the genetics from dad, 25% of the time. We also have the NMDP be the match pool of volunteer donors, which you could potentially find a fully matched donor in. However, a related donor is always better than an unrelated donor, because related donors, such as a matched sibling donor, will match at various minor antigens that we don't always test for. In addition to that, our HLA matching is determined by our ethnicity as well as our genetics. So patients of minority patients will often have difficulty finding a fully matched volunteer donor through NMDP.
Thanks so much for clarifying the terminology. I myself found the term haploidentical so confusing, because I always think that it means a full match just with that terminology. This kind of relates to what you were just saying about sort of who's an ideal candidate for different types of potentially curative therapy for sickle cell disease. Leading on to that question, I wanted to know about contraindications. So of course, for stem cell transplant, if there isn't a match or isn't a haploidentical match, that wouldn't be an option on the table. What are potential contraindications for gene therapy?
So eligibility for commercial gene therapy products is for patients with sickle cell disease. Start with the fact that patients will need to be of the age of 12 or older for a gene therapy infusion. And there are many specifications, such as the minimum number of vaso-occlusive episodes and acute chest syndrome events or hospitalizations that are required to qualify. And this criteria is laid out to help identify patients who are most likely to benefit from the therapy while balancing the safety and efficacy. Patients with sickle cell disease also often can have vasculopathy component to their disease, which includes damage to blood vessels that can result in serious complications such as strokes, silent cerebral infarcts, and other neurological issues. And while gene therapy has shown promising results in significantly decreasing vaso-occlusive crises and improving overall blood flow, the long-term effects specifically on vasculopathy and neurological damage are still being studied. So while vasculopathy and neurological complications from sickle cell disease is not a contraindication for gene therapy, it is still very much so a gray area that we are trying to learn more about.
And I actually was hoping to ask a couple more questions about bone marrow transplant, because we're definitely going to get into more about the gene therapy when we move on from our case. So the bone marrow transplant, you had mentioned that this is very much a classic bone marrow transplant in the sense that this is the similar bone marrow transplant that's also used for leukemia, in the sense that we wipe out your entire bone marrow and then we put in, you know, someone else's stem cells. So therefore, I imagine this has to have the exact same or something similar from an immunosuppression standpoint afterwards, and is going to be a lifelong issue for all the complications that come with bone marrow transplant. Is that correct, or is it something different when we're dealing with sickle cell disease?
No, that is correct, because the process, while the underlying disease and indication for bone marrow transplant is different, whether it's a malignancy or non-malignant condition, the preparative regimen or the chemotherapy that is used to myeloablate or take out the native stem cells from a patient is still there. And so we still have to monitor both for the acute side effects of the chemotherapy, which tend to resolve, as well as the chronic long-term effects from the chemotherapy. So yes, it's very much so the same.
As Sam was asking the question, you know, I was wondering if, you know, if I was a parent and I wanted to sort of have a better understanding of exactly what happens, could you like maybe step us through what to expect in terms of, like, you know, when are they admitted to the hospital? What does this mean to get your bone marrow wiped out? What does that course look like? Just like as an overview, if I'm a parent, what are they expecting to see with their child?
Yeah. So the process for transplant and gene therapy from the hospital standpoint mimic each other pretty closely. When a patient gets admitted to the hospital, they initially start what we call the conditioning phase, where they're receiving their chemotherapy. And based on the preparative regimen that's chosen, this can range anywhere from 22 days to 7 days, 9 days, 4 days, just depends on the chemotherapy regimen that is best chosen for the patient. The patient will remain in the hospital while they're getting their chemotherapy preparative regimen. And we often call these days our negative days, like day minus 7, day minus 6, as we count down to day 0 when we give an infusion of the stem cells. The stem cell infusion sounds much more exciting than it may appear to be. It really just looks like a bag of blood that is being given to the patient. And then we start the recovery period. So then we keep the patient in the hospital after the stem cell infusion until two things happen. One, we wait for the stem cells to engraft, which is a fancy way of saying the stem cells start to find their way into the bone marrow, find a good home in the bone marrow, and start to grow and produce the white blood cells, the red blood cells, and the platelets. And we are also managing the side effects of the chemotherapy that the patient received, which can be nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, many of the classic things that we associate with chemotherapy. This can take up to 20 to 25 days for a transplant patient to have engraftment, and it can take up to 45 days for a gene therapy patient to have engraftment. Overall, we're looking at a hospitalization stay of about 6 to 8 weeks based on any complications and side effects that have to be managed.
And for the bone marrow transplant version, right, we talked about some of the complications that will come from it, lifelong immunosuppression, issues with graft versus host disease, you know, a lot of these different issues. If I was a, if when you're talking about these decisions to the family, if they are HLA match, are you often promoting this because it's a cure versus, as you talked about, gene therapy is more transformative and we don't have enough data, or how are you kind of thinking through, because this isn't just like we turned a switch and off you go and now you're cured, so go live life the way you should.
Yeah. So you mentioned lifelong immunosuppression. So I'm going to go back and just kind of think a little bit about the side effects from chemotherapy.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I break them up into acute side effects that will definitely happen but get better with time, and side effects that will happen and don't get better with time. Side effects that happen but will get better with time are the nausea, the vomiting, the diarrhea, hair loss. All of that goes away. That also includes immunosuppression. Once the new stem cells start to grow and produce white blood cells, the body goes back to being immunocompetent, which is a little bit different than a solid organ transplant where patients do continue to be immunosuppressed for their entire life. So that is one of the biggest differences. So I do expect full immune competency in patients. When I think about side effects from chemotherapy that do not get better with time, one of the biggest things is the risk for infertility. Because of the intensity of chemotherapy that patients receive, patients often will be infertile. And so we have to counsel on fertility preservation options for these patients. And many programs, including the one I'm currently at, offer fertility preservation options. However, insurance typically doesn't cover these services. And that is a really substantial financial barrier for many families. Our team, like many others, will seek donor support, grant funding to help families access fertility preservation and ease this burden. But that's one of the one of the side effects from the chemotherapy for both transplant and gene therapy that I think about as the biggest crux that I talk about with families and is one of the biggest barriers. You then mentioned a little bit about how do you decide between the two for transplant and gene therapy, and that really comes down to all of those nuances that we talked about a little bit ago, where do you have a good donor that would push you one way or the other? Do you have vasculopathy, neurological complications, severe enough that I don't think we have enough data from gene therapy to prove that you'll have a benefit from that? So it really comes down to clinical presentation, donor options. It's a very nuanced process that kind of looks at all of those things.
Thanks so much. And I wanted to bring it back to our case. So, you know, in our case at Cashlec Children's Hospital, Mehi's family is continuing to explore potentially curative therapy. They've found that his sister, who is his only sibling, is not an HLA match. Mehi's family want to meet with you to speak about what gene therapy entails. So you've already sort of discussed a lot of those initial questions about what it might look like for a family. Could you speak a little bit more about what are the risks of gene therapy?
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about what that kind of looks like for families who are undergoing transplant. Some of the differences between transplant and gene therapy. While the inpatient process looks very similar with chemotherapy, stem cell infusion, and monitoring for side effects while waiting engraftment, one of the bigger differences is that gene therapy, because patients are using their own stem cells, we actually take away some of the other risks that come with transplants, such as graft versus host disease and graft failure, because patients typically will not fight off their own cells, so you take away the risk of graft versus host disease. When we think about the other risks of gene therapy, I really think about the side effects of chemotherapy and bring it back to the impact of the preparative regimen or the chemotherapy regimen and the impact on or the resulting infertility that doesn't resolve with time.
And I actually wanted to ask more about gene therapy now, that kind of the nitty gritty details, and then we'll kind of get into what happens over long term. So for like the nitty gritty, what are these companies doing? You know, you mentioned in the beginning that they are taking these out and they are maybe upregulating hemoglobin F, maybe upregulating hemoglobin A, but not necessarily changing the point mutation in hemoglobin SS. Can you kind of explain a little bit actually what the gene modification is, so to speak?
Yeah. So there are two main ways in which the gene manufacturing process happens. One of the most famous or well-known or talked about ways is using the CRISPR-Cas9 method. When I think about the CRISPR-Cas9 method, the easiest way for me to think about it or explain it to some of our families is thinking about it like a pair of scissors. So you're basically using a pair of scissors or the CRISPR-Cas9 editing model to cut out a portion of the faulty gene and put in what you want. And when you're using the CRISPR-Cas9 model, what the intention is that they are doing a genetic modification to upregulate hemoglobin F production. And I personally like to compare this to hydroxyurea that our patients with sickle cell disease take, because what is the end result of hydroxyurea? Increasing your hemoglobin F production. And so why do we like that? Because hemoglobin F helps with anti-sickling properties of any residual hemoglobin S that's there. So that is one method of gene manufacturing. The second method that is used is actually using the intelligence of viruses. Viruses are really clever at getting into our DNA structure, specifically the lentivirus. And the lentivirus has been used in this format in many different manners. Most popularly in the transplant world for CAR T patients with leukemias. But the lentivirus is able to integrate into the DNA and result in a genetic change with the intention to upregulate hemoglobin A production. I personally like to compare this to a blood transfusion, because if you're doing a blood transfusion, we are essentially getting hemoglobin A from a donor. And with using the lentiviral intelligence to genetically modify the stem cells, we are upregulating the production of hemoglobin A and therefore having less hemoglobin S production.
Awesome. So I got some great follow-up questions to that. So we'll start with the hemoglobin A one and then go back to the hemoglobin F. From the hemoglobin A perspective, often the issues with these viruses that then produce their own proteins, which then produce their own something or other, is they can only produce a little bit amount. You know, the total that they can produce is usually not that much. Is there a way? I love the red blood cell transfusion kind of analogy there. Is like, how much hemoglobin A are we actually upregulating? Do you know the percentage? Is it like getting one transfusion? Is it like getting two? Are we now going from what was once 1% hemoglobin A to now, 50%? Or are we just going to 5% and that's all it takes to kind of get rid of the, or decrease the vaso-occlusive episodes? Kind of where is that, where are we at in that, on that production?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So studies have shown that you're getting as much as about 50% hemoglobin A with this new hemoglobin A molecule that's being produced. And then the rest of that mix is still some hemoglobin S and some other hemoglobin A, which is why we kind of refer to it as transformative, because there's still a good amount of hemoglobin S floating around and we don't have enough long-term data at this point to kind of see what that looks like for the patient. But roughly about 50% is what a lot of literature has shown.
I was curious, between those two major options that are available at the moment, and I do appreciate that all of this is brand new and very exciting, I was wondering, is there any sort of clinical factor that would drive at the moment, based on what we currently know, a clinician to choose one over the other, or is it just purely institution dependent, availability dependent?
Yeah, that is the main question that everyone is asking right now. There are no head-to-head trials comparing the two gene therapy products that are commercially available at this time. So a lot of it is institutional dependent. Attempts to try and look at the patient's clinical factors and rationalize if an increase in hemoglobin F or increase in hemoglobin A would be more beneficial. And then it comes down to availability. Not every institution has both products available at this time. So all of those factors will come into play, but there's no clinically correct answer yet.
And to follow up Jennifer's question, is there any difference in their eligibility criteria? Because that might also drive you one way or the other.
The eligibility criteria is exactly the same.
Gotcha. And then my follow-up question before about the hemoglobin F, and you might, as you're not part of any drug companies or anything like that, you might not know the exact answer to this. Do you know why they kind of like, oh, let's do hemoglobin F? It seems like we could have gone after this point mutation. Clearly it's harder than it looks. But why do they choose to cut out and then do a protein for hemoglobin F rather than just try to cut out hemoglobin SS, for example, and put in hemoglobin A?
I think that that is definitely a question for the drug level company.
Question for the drug company. You got it. You can actually cut this out entirely. Yeah,
my assumption is they said hydroxyurea works and increases hemoglobin F, so let's try that. And blood transfusions work through increasing hemoglobin A, so let's try that. But that's an assumption.
It's good. See, clearly, you don't have a conflict of interest from the drug company, or else you might know some of this proprietary information. Whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge about core topics in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a pediatric hospitalist. Figs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular emergency room drama on TV, maybe based in Pennsylvania, yep, they're in figs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids, and kids come with messes, I love that figs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times and they still look brand new. Now, with the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year. Which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for this season. And so, Cribsiders listeners, if you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
This stuff is like really cutting edge. Like, at what point do you think we will actually be able to have enough data for studies to show us what longer term outcomes are? Like, yeah. Do we have to wait another 10 years to actually understand this? Or like, do we have earlier, like through previous trials, like will we have early data at some point?
So we do have some early data with long-term follow-up of about 5 to 6 years post-gene therapy. It's difficult when you compare that to transplant, which has about 50 years of long-term data. So I think we have to continue following these patients, continue enrolling new patients into gene therapy, commercially available products. And then the transplant sickle cell community continues to band together to develop long-term follow-up kind of projects to look at outcomes.
And along those lines, you know, regarding long-term effects, you know, the other thing we talked about is side effects. You had mentioned that most of the side effects that we're concerned about are really in the chemotherapy wiping out your bone marrow stage. How long, you know, as a bone marrow transplant doctor in general, how long past bone marrow transplant do you start to feel really good about the short-term effects being gone and feeling, you know, relatively safe from that perspective?
Yeah. Usually by the time patients go home, a lot of the nausea, vomiting, diarrhea has resolved. Mucositis or sores in the mouth that can develop usually has resolved by the time patients are ready to go home and be discharged from their inpatient stay. With transplant, we continue to worry and follow patients for graft versus host disease, graft failure, graft rejection. And we like to say that the further out you are from transplant, the lower the risks are that one will develop graft versus host disease or graft rejection. For patients with undergoing gene therapy, we don't really have that risk of graft versus host disease since we're using the patient's own cells. And then for both patients, depending on if they're on immunosuppression or not, around 6 to 9 months, and for gene therapy patients, around 6 months, we start to look at the immune system of patients and see if the patient has immune reconstitution and think about revaccinating patients. The chemotherapy that's given as part of the preparative regimen wipes out all of our stem cells, which also wipes out our memory immune system cells. And so we have to revaccinate patients all the way from the beginning of their vaccine schedules.
Wow, that's really interesting. I never thought about that. So you do an entire sort of catch-up vaccination regime post-transplant. Wow.
Yeah.
I was curious, so you mentioned sort of one big difference between risks involved with gene therapy and stem cell transplant being that you don't have the risk of graft versus host disease with gene therapy. I was curious about the conditioning chemotherapy. Are they really similar regimes in terms of intensity and risk? So, for example, we think about short-term, infection risk.
So both gene therapy and transplant conditioning or chemotherapy regimens are gene therapy conditioning regimens at this time are all myeloablative, meaning that we are wiping out the bone marrow, and if we do not give a form of stem cells back, the patient will be aplastic or not kind of develop their own cells again. Transplant typically uses a myeloablative chemotherapy preparative regimen, but there's a lot of movement towards, do we need all the toxicity from a myeloablative preparative regimen? Can we get away with something a little bit lighter, or what we call a reduced intensity conditioning regimen? I do wonder if that's where the next phase of gene therapy will start to look at, is minimizing some of that toxicity from a myeloablative prep to going towards a reduced intensity prep and seeing if we can still get the same same results.
I actually think, this is our first with bone marrow transplant on our show, regardless of whether it's from leukemia or from sickle cell. I think actually this might be a good opportunity just to talk about what graft versus host disease is. If you wouldn't mind just explaining that to our audience, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. So graft versus host disease is when the graft or the stem cells that have been put into the recipient recognizes the host or the recipient as foreign, and the immune cells start to fight each other. And with that fighting, there's inflammation in the body, which can impact any of our organs. Typically, early on, it looks like a skin rash, excessive diarrhea, and liver issues. Chronically, in the long term, it can impact any organ and could be something as simple as dry eyes, lung issues, or worsening skin rashes as well.
It's interesting that it goes to your skin first. Like, why do you fight your skin first and then start to destroy all your other organs? If we are primary care doctors at a hospital, something like that, obviously you're very followed very closely by a oncologist. But nevertheless, if you see a skin rash, what does that skin rash tend to look like?
Yeah, it is a very red, raised, itchy rash, typically starting on the palms of the hand and the soles of the feet, the tips of your ear, and then spreading to the rest of the body.
Awesome. So that's for us to recognize, to recognize this and say, hey, this person just got stem cell or even got gene therapy. Be like, oh, gene therapy, that sounds cool. Oh, no, actually, they had total myeloablative chemotherapy and are at very high risk for, well, I guess in gene therapy itself would not be as risk for graft versus host because they don't have any other ones.
Correct.
Exactly. But we'll just say, or bone marrow transplant, they got cured, and so that's how they got there. Awesome. Thank you very, very much. Okay, guys, I am good with all my questions. You guys go next.
So my one question is, when you were talking about transplant, about whether the graft takes, I assume with gene therapy, there's also a possibility that, is there still a possibility of a graft of their own gene-altered cells doesn't take either?
Yeah, so in theory, that is a possibility. The study that's been done for gene therapy patients, none of the patients experienced graft failure, but we always collect backup stem cells from the patient and keep them in storage in case that does happen and we need to give them back their own stem cells, which unfortunately would mean we're giving them back the stem cells that produce sickle cell.
Could you speak a little bit about the social and ethical considerations around access to curative therapy for sickle cell disease in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question. As we continue to offer all of these curative and transformative options for patients, it's really important that we ensure that there's equal access to these opportunities. Patients from lower socioeconomic status backgrounds often face financial barriers, and even if insurance covers the transplant or gene therapy process, many parents struggle with needing to be out of work to care for their child in the hospital, and juggle bills as well as their other children. Sickle cell disease also predominantly affects people of African descent, and there historically is a lot of healthcare inequities and mistrust amongst this patient population, which can affect both timely referrals and the willingness to pursue these options, to pursue these clinical options, as well as strict clinical eligibility for transplant and gene therapy may unintentionally exclude patients with severe disease who might benefit. So I think ethically, there's a strong responsibility to address these disparities by improving education, improving, expanding insurance coverage, increasing provider awareness, and supporting policies that reduce these financial barriers. Because ensuring equitable access is critical to ensuring that transplant and gene therapy can reach all patients with sickle cell disease.
Excellent. Thank you for answering that question. I know it's not always the easiest one to type to answer for us, and I really appreciate your thoughtful answer to that. As we get down to the sort of the end of our talk together, we have just a couple more questions I think we want to hit. One of them, going back to, you know, we briefly talked about fertility and the impact that this can have on patients. Can you go a little deeper into like how that counseling looks like when you're talking to patients and their families?
Yeah. Fertility counseling is based on the risk that a patient has for infertility, and that risk is based off of the chemotherapy regimen that they'll receive. Patients who are undergoing transplant or gene therapy are typically receiving high enough doses of chemotherapy that we will tell families that their child will be infertile in the future. This comes with the counseling that patients can have fertility preservation options as well, and these options differ based on gender and pubertal status. This is always a very difficult question for families to answer because we are often dealing with parents making a decision for their young child about what they're going to want in their future. And many times parents struggle with this question and whether or not they should pursue a curative or transformative treatment option and jeopardize their child's potential for having children, biological children in the future. And they weigh that along with what their quality of life will look like from the complications of sickle cell disease that the child is facing. And that's always a really difficult struggle. And we generally will talk to families about this multiple times to give them the time and the opportunity to digest and discuss and come up with what is right for their family in that moment.
And what fertility preservation options are available for, say, the five-year-old, right? We talked about the HLA matching bone marrow transplant being the best option when you're young, you know, I would assume prepubertal. So what are the options that are available for them?
Yeah, so when I think about fertility preservation options, pubertal males are generally the easiest to get fertility preservation for because sperm banking is readily available. Pubertal females can undergo egg harvesting if time allows. And then when we think about prepubertal, similar for our patient in this clinical scenario, a prepubertal male, really the option right now is something called testicular tissue cryopreservation, or TTC. And this is still an experimental process, so it's done under a study in which we will remove a portion of the testicular tissue, freeze it, and then when the patient is of age and interested in pursuing biological children, that tissue can then be utilized with assisted medical reproduction. This is similar for prepubertal females with OTC or ovarian tissue cryopreservation. In the post-pubertal females, OTC has proven to have live births. So a little bit less experimental. Awesome. Than TTC.
You know, I can definitely see how a tough conversation that is versus, as you mentioned, the post-pubertal boy, which is classically done just as a 25 or 26-year-old would do.
Yeah.
Yep. And I wanted to ask, so I know that there was a new recent study about haploidentical BMT for sickle cell disease that's sort of the source of a lot of discussion. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that study, if you could take us non-BMT people through the basics and whether that changes your clinical practice at all.
Yeah, I think haploidentical transplants for patients with sickle cell disease continues to be a gray area for many people. I personally think that it is a great option for many of our patients who have severe disease burden from their sickle cell disease, do not have a matched sibling donor, and because of how severe their disease burden may be, there are a lot of unknowns with gene therapy for those patients. So I think that this expands the donor pool for patients with sickle cell disease who have a high disease burden. So I personally feel like haploidentical stem cell transplants is a really great option. That publication definitely had very good results, more so on the adult arm than the pediatric arm. There were a few more graft failures on the pediatric arm, which I think there are newer trials that are up and coming that are going to try and alter the regimen a little bit to try and overcome that.
I'm going to kind of ask the final topic more from the generalist perspective. So say this patient got it doesn't matter which treatment they got. Say they got one of the treatments, and it's been 5 years now. We'll say it's been 5 years. And at what point do you graduate them from your clinic? And then along the same token, what should we know if you did graduate them and they're just seeing primary care? Like, what are these patients like? What should we know? What's the complications? Anything that we should be most aware of that we should call back that oncologist and say, uh-oh, I just saw something and you should know about it?
So the transplant world is very protective of our patients post-transplant, but we do graduate them back out of our clinics into their primary care physicians, but at most institutions, these patients will continuously be plugged into a form of survivorship clinic. So there will always be a yearly follow-up for these patients to monitor for long-term side effects of chemotherapy and to continue to look for the success of either transplant or gene therapy. I think it's really important for the primary care physicians to continue to manage many of the day-to-day things that are going to come up for these patients that we are not specialized in. For example, many times we'll have patients calling us and saying, oh, I slammed a door on my finger. What should I do? And yes, we've built that rapport with the families, but may not be as well informed to address that as their primary care physician. So one of the biggest things that we tell our families and that I'd encourage primary care physicians to think about is rebuilding that relationship with the parents and with the children. They've been out of that world and so reliant on the transplant community and team for so long that it will take a little bit to rebuild that relationship. But once that happens, it's really important for the primary physician to rebuild that relationship with the families and the patients. In terms of things to look out for, any of those scary skin rashes, anything that looks a little bit funny on a CBC can always be sent back to us and send us an email or a call, and we're always more than happy to answer those questions.
And so now I'm going to flip it around a little bit as well from almost like a hematology perspective. Say the patient's 22. You know, they've long gone from their the hematologist isn't following them closely. Survivorship is once a year, but the hematologist doesn't follow closely. And now they have like bilateral arm pain, or, you know, they have bilateral leg pain, something that used to maybe mimic a vaso-occlusive episode. When should I be thinking and treating these patients like they have hemoglobin SS, or when should I be like, you know what? this patient is cured. Like, this is not on my differential, and my differential is about to change, and I need to worry about something else. Same thing when it comes to acute chest syndrome. Same thing when it comes to any of the complications that we're worried about, a sickle cell disease. Like, when do I say this patient shouldn't have those things, my differential should change, or I'm going to go to my automatic, what's common is common, and this is sickle cell?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I heard a lecture a while ago, which brings up a really good point to kind of remember for the primary care physicians, which is that it paralleled a patient with sickle cell disease to a brick wall. And sickle cell disease is a hammer. It's breaking that brick wall. And the damage that's done is done. Transplant or gene therapy takes away that hammer. It takes away sickle cell disease and it prevents progression of disease. But a lot of that chronic pain or damage that's already been done by sickle cell disease will remain there. And patients who have any lingering complications from sickle cell disease should be plugged into a subspecialist to help manage that, whether it's chronic kidney disease, retinopathy, chronic pain. And then you bring up the question of, okay, well, how do I, moving forward, know if it's not one of their chronic complications from sickle cell disease, how do I know if a new problem is related to sickle cell disease or related to one of the many other differentials? If you ever question where a patient stands with their cure from sickle cell disease, running a CBC and a hemoglobin electrophoresis will give you that answer. If you see a sky-high S percent or a anemia that is concerning to you, reaching back out to that transplant physician or to the survivorship team to talk about it would put you back into concern for this is a sickle cell issue. But if that electrophoresis and CBC is normal, thinking about your other differentials is a good way to go.
That's super helpful. And just for electrophoresis, just the, you know, just for us, you know, what is that number that you're going to say? You say sky high. I don't know what sky high is. You know, it sounds like we should roughly have hemoglobin A at 50%-ish. You know, at what level are you going to really experience? I guess this is a good question for the hemoglobin. You know, this is along the lines of the trait and things like that. But what's a norm? What's a level or number that we should not be concerned about? And what is a number that we should be concerned about?
Yeah. So for patients who have undergone stem cell transplant, their hemoglobin electrophoresis will mimic that of their donors. If their donor does not have any impact from sickle cell disease, you'll see a normal hemoglobin electrophoresis spread with 0% S. If their donor had trait, you'll see as much S as their trait donor exhibits. And that usually can be found in one of our transplant notes. For patients with gene therapy, you would want to look for consistency on that S percent and A percent and F percent from the time of gene therapy onwards.
Oh, that's interesting. And that makes me think about what a huge shift that is for us as clinicians to see a patient with sickle cell disease post one of these therapies. And it must be, you know, a much, much larger shift for them personally of an order of magnitude to be having lived with sickle cell disease and have, you know, a whole new scenario post-curative or transformative therapy. So thank you so much for the conversation. And I wanted to just ask you, you know, because we've covered so much, what do you think are the really, really big take-home messages for general pediatricians? What would you like general pediatricians or a general audience to know about transformative and curative therapies for sickle cell disease?
Yeah, I think right now our biggest barrier is access. And so most patients with sickle cell disease are already connected to a hematology team, but just early identification, timely referrals to transplant are essential because this allows families to begin discussions and make informed decisions about whether transplant or gene therapy are the right option for them. A consultation with a transplant team does not obligate families to pursue curative or transformative therapies, and I think that's really important to keep in mind. The goal of that consult is really just to provide an opportunity to learn about all the available treatment options so that families can make an educated decision for their children.
Awesome. Thank you so much for, you know, spending the time with us tonight to just go over all this. This is super informative for me. Like this, I just didn't know much about it, honestly, any of this. So it was very, very useful. And hopefully our listeners got a lot out of this. Before we go, is there anything you would like to plug? Any websites or organizations that you want our listeners to check out before we go?
Definitely take a look at NMDP and Be the Match and submit a swab to try and be a donor and see whose life you can impact with that.
Wow, that is a great plug and a reminder for me to do that.
Awesome.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much. Well, I'll have to bring you back some other time. Maybe we can talk more about other sickle cell.
Yeah, of course. Would love that. Thank you guys so much for having me.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders. Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula feed newsletter at our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Jennifer Chisholm, and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz on X Blue Sky and Instagram. I've been Sam Azer.
I've been Jennifer.
And this has been Chris the Chew Manchu. Thank you and good night. And for those who made it to the end, of course, you're going to have a horrible AI poem. It's called Breaking the Sickle. From sickled cells that block and bind, to hope that science now can find, to cure once dream now real and near, for children who have lived in fear. Two paths emerge from research halls, gene therapy's precise new calls, and transplants proven tested way to chase the sickle cells away. CRISPR cuts with careful art, while donor cells can make fresh start. Both roads are hard with risks to weigh, but offer hope for brighter days. No more crisis, pain, and ache when healthy blood the body makes. The sickle curves become a line as hemoglobin learns to shine. Good night, guys. See ya.